Christmas spirit, because I know I'm always in the Christmas spirit.
Baking up and getting back together. Baking. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kimminick Talks. I am Dominic, and this you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. I am joined today by my co-host, Kim.
Hi, I let Dominic do the intro, and I didn't know he was going to do it, but he did. Good job.
And we are really glad to be joined today by none other than John McDonald. Esteemed music professor in the Tufts Music Department. Hi, John.
Hi, Dominic. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Kimminick, right?
Yes. Yeah. Both parts of Kimminick Talks. We were just hearing Leon Lee play a harmonica piece, a solo harmonica piece, right?
That's right.
In Disler Hall. When was that from?
That was October 24th. As part of a Tufts Composers concert, and that was the premiere, and
of the piece.
The piece is called Counting Canto, and canto being song. So it's just a single line melody, as you can probably hear. The thing about it that might interest listeners, if you heard it, is. Okay, I'm going to start reading a little thing here.
Sure.
To play and understand how counting canto works, the harmonica soloist needs to be able to count to 37.
Can he do that?
Yeah, it turns out he can.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Using the Padovan sequence, which is a sequence of numbers that is a little bit like the Fibonacci series.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a kind of trajectory to it.
Right.
So it's sort of 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, 12, 16, 21, 28, and 37. And that's as far as I go. It keeps going, but I stop it at 37. So there's like a 37-note phrase. And the way it works is you play up to the 37-note phrase, and you're ascending the whole time. And you get to a high point on the harmonica. And then you descend. Using the same proportions, only the descent is interrupted by two verses of a Korean folk song.
The reason for
this was that Leon, as I think you know, Dominic, he was asked to play a spot on the 11th Seoul International Harmonica Festival. So I thought I'd put in a little... allusion to Korea using this tune called Arirang, which is kind of, it's like a de facto Korean national anthem. So two verses of that interrupt the descent,
mm-hmm.
where you're kind of going back to the Padovan numbers, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And
it makes as much sense as how you explained it.
Great. So, and he's a wonderful player. Just to say something about Leon, he's a doctoral student in mechanical engineering at Tufts.
Mm-hmm.
He manufactures harmonicas. He works on reeds. He works on the parts. What metal do you use? What's going to improve or change the tone? What's the embouchure like? If you know harmonica, you play it with ingressive breathing as well as blowing out. So it's very tricky to play smooth.
Yeah.
So this is a pretty smooth piece. And you can hear that it doesn't sound really like a flute, but he also plays the flute. So anyway, I've really enjoyed that as a new instrument in my life. Let's put it that way. Well, his harmonicas specifically. And so every time he shows up, and we're going to rehearse or do something, he's got a new thing going on. So the last time he pulls out this, oh, here, I've played you this before, haven't I? It's a bass harmonica. All right?
How big is that?
It's small, but it's in the cello range. So it goes down to the low C of the cello. And I thought, all right, now I have to write a piece for bass harmonica leading to the one you just heard. With some piano involved. So I'm going to work on that. And so that's going to be called Something Else Comes Up.
Nice.
And it literally comes up, goes up.
Yeah.
but also things are going to happen.
You've been working with Leon a lot recently, right? I see him in your office very frequently.
Yeah, I guess you happened to be there when we're there. Okay, I mean, we were meeting once a week for a while, so that's been pretty consistent.
And are you technically like on his PhD committee in some sense, or are you just a collaborator with him?
I am not at all on his PhD committee.
Okay.
I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm, as I think I told you, I'm retiring at the end of next semester, so I'll be around some, but doing different things.
Yeah. Is this the first time you've worked so closely with somebody who is, rather than being a music-centered academic, a mechanical engineering-centered?
Tufts is interesting because, as you know, we have a lot of joint programs with engineering. So over the years, I have gotten involved in some things. One of the theses where I was a committee person was, I don't remember the name of the thesis, but it was about cryogenically freezing trumpets. To see if the if freezing them would make them sound better.
And did it?
The thesis was unfortunately inconclusive, but it was certainly very interesting. And then another one was a project that was funded in part by Steinway, the piano company, and it was a piano action project experiment. And one of the composers that was studying with me at the time was working on that. I didn't have any direct involvement in that, but it's, right. You know, those are the kind of crossovers. Mm-hmm. And then these excerpts that we're talking about, I played earlier in the week for Richard Townsend's CS class, computer science class, which is called Algorithmic Composition. So what I just explained, the numbers and the way it's constructed, is basically an algorithm for how the piece works. So the other things that we could listen to if they come up are from that set of things that I took over there to play.
Did you volunteer your craft, or did they ask you to come in and talk the class?
This is how it happened. Okay. Justin Mitchell, who's now a graduate student in computer science, but was an undergraduate last year, took a composition class with me. He actually wrote for Leon in that class because Leon, we wrote some chamber music for Leon, and Anna Griffiths, our music department publicity coordinator and also peerless violist, played chamber music with him and played some of the things that students in the class had written. And Justin was in that class, Justin Mitchell. Mm. So he then the next semester took algorithmic composition, and then upon leaving that class said to Richard, if you teach it again, ask McDonald to come and talk. So I did. That's how that happened.
That's cool. Do you think that your... I want to say that a lot of your work, a lot of the things I've heard you, that you've composed, at least, I don't know if algorithmic is the right word, but you definitely like to follow, like you like to make some sort of theme or game or rule for each piece, or some, not maybe not every single piece, but for a lot of them. Do you agree that that is a central point in your frequent short form compositions? Is that you? I don't know. I think some of them are humorous. Some of them are. You definitely taught me to think about it in a way that, you know, a piece can definitely be about something or for something, and it can sound like that. I think you had one about bubbles popping, or.
Did I?
Right, something like that.
That would be cool.
I think you had one, no? Or you did not have one about bubbles.
I don't think that... Maybe I did. I'll have to think back. I just don't remember right now.
Yeah. Where is water or something?
I have one that's called Like Foam.
Like Foam.
And the idea there is, I'll tell you where that came from. I played a piece years ago by Yehudi Weiner, who is a very distinguished composer who lives in Medford. He's in his advanced 90s now, and very healthy, as far as I know. He wrote a clarinet and piano piece that I played, and in several places in the piano part it said, like vapors, meaning he wanted this very light, wispy playing. And I thought, okay, like foam would be very similar, but a little different. So I'll have to look back at that piece. I haven't really finished it yet, but so that's as close as I get to bubbles popping,
right,
I think.
Right. Have you always composed in this way? I don't know what the word is to describe it, but you know what I'm talking about.
I haven't always composed, period.
Okay.
But since I was a kid, I was a kid composer, so I started...
Almost always, then, it sounds like.
Yeah, I would say, you know, except for maybe the first 9 years.
Okay.
I think I started when I was nine.
That's okay. You know, you were busy being a kid.
Yeah, you got to be a kid. It's actually fun to be a kid when you compose, too.
That's
kind of like that.
That could be your next piece, composing as a kid and being a composed kid.
Kids have trouble composing themselves, though, don't they?
That's true. Yeah. When I took your class, I mean, I think a lot of your titles have puns, but there was one that you talked about that had a pun in the name, and I'm not going to remember what it is. But what was the first thing you composed, I guess? Do you remember?
No. I remember an early thing where, I forget what I called it, but it was kind of an imitation of Sibelius, the Finnish composer that some of you may know. I thought he was great, and so I pretended I was like that.
So you were listening to, is Sibelius a classical composer?
Yeah, listening to his orchestral music. There was a symphonic poem called Finlandia, which was kind of, I don't know, I don't think it's his greatest piece now, but it's kind of big and muscular. And I did listen to another tone poem of his just the other day called Tapiola, which is a later thing. I won't be able to tell you what Tapiola is, but it's a place in Finland.
Okay.
I believe, or a legend. So it's a Finnish-oriented story. But it's very melancholy, gorgeous orchestral piece. So I was glad to listen to that again. Mm-hmm. So I was into Sibelius as a kid.
How did that happen?
Fantasizing that I would be a composer. You know, it's just a fantasy life.
Orchestral music was being played around you.
Yeah. My parents had this, they had kind of an, I forget what it was called, but it was like a series of international classical music or something like that. And it was just one of those things like encyclopedias that they used to sell. Or there was something called the International Library of Classical Music, which the public library in my town had. So I poured through that. I just got interested in music kind of young.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was doing.
And then you started composing, and you didn't stop.
Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much true. When I first went to college, I composed and played through high school, but then going to college, I had this period where I thought, okay, I should be practicing, and I didn't compose as much, but that was pretty short-lived. And then, you know, you have the struggle, should I be a composer or be a pianist? And that also was very short lived. And I just decided, okay, I'll do both.
Right. I, if I recall correctly, your bio, says you are a composer.
I'm a composer who tries to play the piano and a pianist who tries to compose.
Right. And so at this point, do you consider those to be two things that you're trying to do at the same time? Or do you think that they are you personally can all separate them?
They're pretty much one thing. You don't have to play to be a composer.
No.
You don't have to compose to play.
No.
But it's pretty interesting when you do both, and when both have a kind of fluency to them, and then it just feels more natural, I think.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's really just about time spent. I spend my time doing those things, so it's kind of, people have said to me, oh, that sounds like a modest way of describing what you do, and I'm like, well, no, it's just what it is.
Yeah. And so these short form pieces that are about things, or for people, or about, how do you develop them? Because I know a big part of your musical philosophy is composing by hand and sketching them out. And so when you're sketching these things to start an idea, are you sketching it and kind of listening to what your sketch sounds like, or are you sitting and sketching for a while before you even take it to the piano?
That's a great question. I've gone through phases where there were different things that happened in that spectrum of possible ways of doing things. So I do write by hand.
Mm-hmm.
Pencil and paper, preferred technology. I have never used notation software, which is kind of terrible on one level, because it's so ubiquitous and it's a skill that needs to be taught. And so I can't teach it, but I can have a dialogue with it, which
right.
I mean, actually you and I have had that dialogue, because you've engraved some of my stuff.
I'm pretty sure I engraved Count and Conto, right?
You did, yeah. I just didn't give you the corrections yet. So you know how I work on that. It's like, we'll do these things, and then it takes me forever to do the editing.
You've got more, you're composing, you're busy composing.
Yeah, doing other things.
Yeah.
But it will happen. I'll get to it, because I think Leon plays that piece extremely well, and it's worth having it in a sort of publishable form. Mm. So it's true that the hand manuscript is usable. Like, what my habit is to sketch, get the piece out, and then do a final fair copy of it. So if it was going to be left in manuscript, that would be it. The piece is done. But it's interesting to have the extra step of working with a copyist to engrave it, because it looks different. Some of my habits don't translate to engraved / note set software.
This is
as
true.
As you figured out.
As I've seen.
And that's fine. So it's, you know, you want it to be, to say what it says, and for someone to be able to play the piece the way it goes from either one. Okay.
Yeah.
But I can sometimes offer with hand manuscript more information, a bit of personality, like the hand manuscript has a kind of visual personality.
Yeah, for sure.
Which software can also take on depending on choices that you make, right? Are the notes big? Are the notes small? Are there a lot of page turns? Are there a few? You know, how do you do phrasing? What software do you choose?
Sure.
All of those things give you some visual variety. But for me, it's like an even longer editing process, which is interesting.
Yeah.
I'll say one more thing about this. This is a slightly different topic, but I've learned that post-production, when you make a recording, and I know both of you are also involved in sound recording, that's another step in a compositional process. So
right.
Going back to hand manuscript. So, okay, you start, you get an idea.
Mm-hmm.
The miniatures that you referred to usually are inspired for me by words or phrases. So
yeah.
I might find that in a poem, it might be something I'm reading, it might be something that somebody says on the radio or just in person.
What are some examples of your favorite titles?
Oh, that's, well, I'll give you somebody else's title. This is a good pun. I just looked at it before I came over here because I was going through old stuff in my office. World Series.
What was the first word?
World. So I'm saying it the way, what was the baby's name on The Simpsons?
Oh, not Lisa. There was a little one.
Yeah. There was this whole episode about, do you pronounce WH? Do you pronounce the H in WH? And I did it in this case because it's whirled, WHIRLED.
Mm-hmm.
And series refers to a 12-tone row. And whirled is to throw it around. But the composer, Milton Babbitt, was also a fan of the World Series.
Oh.
Baseball World Series.
Yeah.
So that's a nice pun.
Yeah.
Back to the algorithmic.
So you're taking us through the process.
Yeah. So start with some kind of idea about what the piece is about.
Mm-hmm.
Start to sketch it. Match that idea with some sounds, usually improvised.
Mm-hmm.
For me, usually improvised on the piano. Then I'll flesh it out. And that's where the sometimes the iterative processes or techniques, algorithmic things if you want. I guess any rule is kind of an algorithm. So I do like following rules because it gives the music a personality.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes in a particular way.
Yeah.
Right? And you can recognize the way this part goes from the way that part goes.
Yeah.
So there might be a few things that I'll collect that happen in one piece.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you eventually, because you were talking about how you you now consider post-production in your, well, not consider beforehand, but
some intermediary
end of the steps.
Intervening steps. So we get to the point where I've decided kind of what the piece is about, and I try to execute something that will inevitably surprise me. Like, I don't want to plan too much because I love this sense of being in the process that I've kind of created with the idea, but I don't know everything it's going to do.
And then
I'll go like, oh, this really doesn't sound good. Let's do something else. Or now that's enough of that. Now let's do something else. But the piece isn't over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, little moments like that. I like it when that happens because you have to be on your toes and sort of think of something to do to save the day, so to speak. So I like that part of it. But anyway, once the piece is drafted, then I'll go to the fair copy thing where I'll think. And sometimes when I'm writing for different instruments, that'll involve some more editing, maybe fleshing out some things that I just did a shorthand for or thought about but didn't commit to. So the fair copy process will be really committing to the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that there may not be some kind of miscalculation, and then once it gets played, I need to change it again, and I'll just do a new fair copy.
Right.
Okay. And then mostly after it's performed, or in some cases in anticipation of a performance, I'll do the engraving process with someone else, so yourself or a former grad student who has done a lot of copying for me. And then post-production. So let's say you've had the piece performed, all that stuff is done, it's published or whatever. Whoops, I hit the microphone. So you make a recording, and then you're going to put it out as a recorded example of something. So then you start this whole process over all again, really, because
mm-hmm.
You're listening to takes, you're listening to bits of it in some cases. You're trying to put it back together and make it what it is. And I like that process when it's collaborative, when I'm working with an engineer
mm-hmm.
to do that. And so Joel Gordon, who you may have heard of, he was Peter Atkinson's mentor, and I've known him since he worked at WGBH Radio in the 1980s, recording a lot of local musicians and doing some amazing radio broadcast projects, and you know, then moved into location recording and has done all kinds of recording in the Boston area. So that'll give me new. I usually walk out of those sessions with new ideas for new pieces,
right.
And you know, the whole thing just keeps going.
Yeah, and when I've done some of your things, I see a number, OP, some large number. So
yeah, opus numbers. That's just I started doing that just so I could keep track.
Yeah. So is that comprehensive? Like, are keeping track, you add to that number every time you compose a piece, or is that only, because when I was doing it, the number was at, the one that I was working on was like number 998 or something like that.
It's not that high.
It's not that high?
No.
Okay.
But it's 700 something.
Okay.
It's close.
And is it still in that range?
Yeah, it's still going. So what I know I'm going to do generally in a given year is make more piano music, small to medium-sized piano pieces. I used to write some longer things. There are 8 sonatas. The last sonata, I think, was in the 1990s somewhere. Mm-hmm. But then I just kind of went away from that and started liking smaller forms better. And a lot of times I'll reuse the short piano pieces in larger things. Like I'll orchestrate them, or there'll be a string orchestra version of some of them that has been kind of repurposed and reordered into a different piece. So I guess you'd call that recycling.
And you may write a piece about that.
Pardon me?
You might write a piece about that.
Yeah, sure. And their way, and you know, processes recycle themselves too. You know, to go back to algorithms.
Do you want to play another one of your songs that you showed to the class? Talking about algorithms.
If you want to hear one,
I would. We can do the example number 2 if you'd like.
Yeah, that's a little longer. That's a 10-minute piece.
We could do a portion of it.
Okay.
Looks like you've got a Fleetude.
Yeah, that's a piece that Peter Atkinson actually recorded commercially.
So that's what is the link is a recording of his?
The link is a track that preceded the actual commercial recording.
Mm.
Yeah. But there is a CD out with that piece on it. It's called The Boston Etudes. But we could play. This is another live concert piece. So we can play that if there's time.
Thoughts on the Way or Fleetude? Yeah. Do you have a preference?
Thoughts on the Way.
Okay.
What time is it now?
It is 5:40.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so we should only play this, I think. But
sure.
Fleetude is on the Boston Etudes, which is on New Focus Records, with pianist Jihe Chang playing fancy piano pieces by 8 different Boston composers. How do you like that?
8.
Yeah, 8 of us.
And this Thoughts on the Way I just saw is for what instrumentation?
This is for violin and cymbalom.
And what is that instrument?
A cymbalom is a Hungarian hammer dulcimer, essentially. So it's a tabletop size instrument with exposed strings that you play with hammers or mallets. It's ergonomically insane.
Okay.
So where the notes are in this tabletop set of strings is fascinating. And so there is one virtuoso cymbalom player in the Boston area called Nicholas Toll.
One and only?
He's the only one that I know. There was another. I actually played a piece that involved Cymbalum. I think it might have even been before Nick was born. But
wow.
But he actually owns the Cymbalum that the other person played when I played that piece in the 1980s. So it's really fun to think about. But he has a new one that was made for him, and that's the one that he travels with, so to speak. So you'll hear that it's not as, how could I put this, not as finely tuned as many Western orchestral instruments that you'll hear, and okay. It's essentially a folk instrument.
Right.
So Zoltán Kodály wrote for the Cymbalum. Stravinsky wrote for it, and Georg Kurtág, who is a still living Hungarian composer who was born in 1926, so he's going to be 100 next year.
Wow.
He's written quite a repertory for the Cymbalum. So this duo, violin and cymbalum, was formed. It's called Lampth, LAMNTH.
Oh.
And it's Lilit Hartunian on the violin and Nick on cymbalum.
Right.
And this is called, they asked me for a piece, and this is called Thoughts on the Way. And it's dreaming, it's imagining what Lilit might be thinking as she walks to Nine Bar, which is the cafe in Davis Square that has really good coffee. And we've met there a few times to talk about things. So the subtitle is Nine Bar Duets Studies. So every piece, there are nine bar pieces inside this piece. And that's the algorithm of that one.
And the pun.
At the risk of talking too much, yeah,
right.
That is a pun.
That's
a
pun.
You're right.
Did they know over at Nine Bar that you composed a piece for them?
Not yet.
About them?
Not
Did
yet.
Did they play music in this cafe?
Well,
it's like a window.
It's a window. So you walk up to
I
it.
I know what you're talking about, actually. Well,
you should let them know.
Maybe they want to play.
Slide it under their window.
Yeah, I should just. You're right. I will do that.
Don't let it go unnoticed. All right, well.
Do you want to listen?
Yeah, so they're nine. Each of the nine little things has titles. So why don't we play up to, I don't know, what do you want to do, 2 minutes?
Sure,
that sounds good. 2.5 minutes?
Yeah, and then maybe after we'll do a quick PSA, and then we'll keep talking about it.
Okay, so the first few are called Rugs Pulled Out,
okay.
What Little We Have, None Other Than the Everyday World, and Remaining Like a Log. We might not get all the way through Remaining Like a Log. So here you go. This is Thoughts on the Way, Violin and Cymbalum.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
That was fun, and we were looking up. Can you repeat the Kalimbum? Repeat the name.
Yeah,
that
was from a piece that I wrote called "Thoughts on the Way" for violin and cymbalom. This Hungarian hammer dulcimer that's the size of a table, and Dominic was just looking at pictures of it, and it's it's unfamiliar to a lot of us. But what I'll say is, when he first started playing it, Nick gave me a kind of life-size aerial view of where the notes were on it as a sort of a poster, and I used to have it hung up in my office.
Oh, that's really cool.
It was sort of like on the corner there where the speakers are here in the studio, and I would look at it and go like, how's he going to do this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's big, right?
It's big, and also he requests a certain size of page. He can't use an iPad because he can't see it, and also can't control it when he's sitting behind this thing. Mm. So he needs music.
A big poster.
Yeah, he needs music of a certain size.
Yeah.
Too big is not great either.
Yeah.
So he's figured out through the experience of doing what he does what he needs. So that's also, you know, it becomes an issue with copying, because I can't give him hand manuscript.
No.
I can give him that to see what it is, but then we have to go the rest of the way and engrave. So, there you go.
Huge.
Yeah.
Interesting.
8.5 by 14 is the preferred size.
Wow.
So, yeah, big paper. And
that's amazing. Do we want to do a PSA?
Yeah, we've got a PSA here.
It's been prepared.
Some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates 24% of its prisoners and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. This is a public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Is there a date on that? Because I would think that the numbers are probably more now.
Those percentages I would say they might be larger.
Yeah.
The 5% of the population is probably the one that's the most consistent.
Mm.
But I would predict that the others are higher.
Yeah. Numbers to think about.
Thanks for the PSA.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still composing your composing pieces for your courses that you are teaching, your composing courses?
Yeah, I just had the last class this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Of the practicum, which is the Friday class.
New at noon.
Yeah, and New Sounds Now is, so Dominic's asking me about classes that I teach at the school.
Awesome.
And so there's a concert series that's attached to each of the classes. So I do a contemporary composition seminar course, and that has with it something we call New Sounds Now. And then the other one is Composition Practicum, and that series is called New at Noon.
And how long have New at Noon and New Sounds Now been running?
New Sounds Now is newer.
Okay.
And New at Noon, we started, before the Granoff Center was built.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what was Tufts Music? Where was Tufts Music before the Granoff Center?
I was telling someone else this today.
It's hard for me to imagine.
Someone was asking me about the New Music Ensemble, which I do want to reminisce about WMFO MFO a little bit, which I told you.
Right.
So just in our last few minutes here, I can blab about that stuff.
Sure.
So you asked me when...
What was it like?
Where were we before the Granoff Center?
What was it like?
So Granoff Center was opened in February of 2007. And then we did a sort of opening ceremony that semester, and we were off and running. And that changed those of us who had been here teaching before we had that building. That changed our lives more than anything that I could tell you. We got pianos. We got a state-of-the-art concert hall, as you right. know, which now you work in. Mm-hmm. We didn't have that before. So when I came to Tufts, the music department was in 20 Professors Row, which is the little gray house that's kind of between the two sides of Sophia Gordon, up the hill from the current music department.
Oh.
So I got hired to start the new music ensemble at Tufts in 1990. And so
For that specifically?
There was that, and then to teach composition. So I had a couple of private students. There wasn't an organized composition course other than a sort of independent study registration process. And so then the courses that evolved into are the ones that I've been teaching, mm-hmm. you know, lately. So anyway, we did the ensemble in the living room of that house.
Okay. Wow.
And and I directed that group and taught two classes. That was my load for the first part of my faculty time. And then Donald Berman, who is now the mm-hmm. faculty member who directs Enemy, we call it Enemy, the new music ensemble. And there was a third faculty member who was who played with us. She's a musicologist called Catherine Bergeron, and she played flute and sang in the group. And Don is a fantastic pianist and wonderful experimental music ensemble director. So he's doing that. We did it together for a few years. I don't remember how we made that work, but we did. And we enjoyed working together on that. So Enemy played at WMFO on the radio in 1994. And I remember that instead of piano pieces, we played pieces of piano, because there was a piano that had been destroyed, like in one of the other rooms over here. And so it was an upright, and the bottom harp was kind of exposed, and the keyboard didn't work, and so on. But we used it in our improvisations for that show. It was awesome. And so I was thinking I'd come up here today. I haven't been here. I might have been up here since then, but it looks recognizably the same. And I was thinking it would be totally different.
Nope.
So the piano is not here anymore, however.
Mm-mm. But we do have a saw, like a handsaw and a bow in Studio B, so you can get a nice S curve and make some music there.
We played that piano with that saw. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm really surprised that saw
that
is
sounds like new music
shining
ensemble.
New.
So
you want to talk about WMFO?
Yeah, I wanted, this is another radio station, WBUR. So Enemy also guested on WBUR about 4 years later, and that was a call-in show. And I believe that there's someone who I was telling this to today who would like to do a show like that here, WMFO, so that you take callers and they get to request what kind of improvisation they want. So we did this. This was a syndicated show called The Connection with a host called Christopher Lydon. So it was like a national audience. So they had us in the studio. There were six of us. There was no piano. The host kind of introduced us. We played a few recordings of things we had done, and then we went to calls. And I was really nervous because I thought nobody's going to call, or they're going to go, can you play some Gershwin, you know, that sort of thing, which we could not do. The first caller says, I'm calling from Iowa. I sit in the same chair and listen to this show every day for 2 hours because I can barely move. I have rheumatoid arthritis. Can you play about my pain? So I was floored.
Yeah.
So we did something, and we were telling people, oh, we'll play for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, whatever you want. So I think we played for a minute and a half. Mm-hmm. And then the host went back to the caller and said, well, so what did you think? He said, that was exactly it.
Wow.
Wow.
And I think what I was saying to this person today was that taught me that music has this sort of wish fulfillment magic. Mm. That, you know, like we were talking about my titles and things.
Yeah.
So when you say that it's about something, you can actually get the materials, your responsibility, so to speak, as a composer or improviser, is to say, these materials